Wednesday, hump day, December 11th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Well, it's kind of nippy out there. I'm just saying, yesterday was Acapulco. It was like 50 degrees. It was ridiculous. Today, it's like really crisp and cold. You know how bad it is? This is how bad it is.
How bad is it?
So the woman who I walk with said to me, you know, I've got this long down coat that I really don't wear anymore, but it will cover your tush. And you don't even have a tush to cover, but you really do need something longer that covers your you-know-what. And so she brought it over to me this morning. I'm wearing it right now. It's very – well, it's kind of tacky looking, but it does cover my tush. It's really nice to be warm down there. Anyway, for those of you who need to know this information, this is why you listen to The Attitude. You learn the weather about New Hampshire. It is cold and crisp. And now you know that I don't have a you-know-what ASS. And on that note, Mr. Barnes, there you go. I said, this is what happens at 7 o'clock in the morning when I go walking. I just want people to know, this is why you should walk with me in the morning. I mean, think about what you learn. You think you learn about the world? No, you learn about the weather and you learn about what kind of clothing I wear. Okay, now
I
tell me what's
going on. I have to tell you that I don't. I can't follow that, Arnie.
What
does one say?
I know. How do you follow that?
After a conversation about
you need a longer coat, too. Tuchus. You need a covering one's tuchus. It's so
amazing. I have plenty of ones to cover.
It's so funny.
People.
Here it is. See, here's the jacket. I'll even take a picture and put it up on the Facebook page.
Really?
Yes. Okay. Leave me alone. I'm grateful she noticed. Okay, yes, darling. What's floating your boat on this incredibly exciting day?
Well, it's a very exciting day. It's a beautiful day out,
I think. It's very cold and crisp, but it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Yeah. I mean, I would much rather have a day like this than one that's rainy and cloudy and snowy and icy and wind blowing and the wind chill factor being sub-zero, which I guarantee we're going to have in a few weeks now.
Yeah.
So I'll take it.
Okay.
I'll take it. Bernie Sanders is not being covered by the mainstream media. I know that I've mentioned this once or twice before, and a lot of other people have too.
Mm-hmm.
But how is it possible that – I mean, I can answer that question. It's not completely rhetorical, though. How is it possible that media who call themselves real journalists can fail to cover Bernie Sanders? I remember reading a headline that Biden was number one and Warren was tied with somebody for number three, and they don't mention that Bernie's in there at a close number two.
Yeah.
Or not even mentioning that he's in the running, you know, talking about what's good or bad about Elizabeth Warren, talking about what's good or bad with Joe Biden, how cute Pete Buttigieg is, whether his McKinsey ties too much loop him in with Wall Street. But it's like Bernie doesn't exist. And yet on the ground here in New Hampshire, I could certainly see it. And believe elsewhere as well. You know, huge numbers of people are turning out. They're really gung ho. And it's not a cult of personality. It's not like the guy has
personality. I've known him for 40 years. Bernie is Bernie. And yet, you know what? There's not only a level of authenticity with Bernie, but he has been beating this drum for 40 years. He's never been bought and sold. He doesn't go through revolving doors. He's never worked for a corporation. No corporation would hire him. But he wouldn't want to. And so in a lot of ways, he's been able to be virtuous for a very long period of time. And he's never really sort of veered off for like a two-year hiatus. He's always been there.
Right.
And I think there's that sense of reliability and that sense of and what he's been talking about. If we had done it 40 years ago, we wouldn't be where we are
today.
Country
would be a lot better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the middle class would be thriving. The climate would be better. Labor unions would be stronger. Our educational system would be better. When you look back at what he said 40 years ago, you want that world today.
Right, right. And he would have taken the FDR New Deal and America's
and he would have
growing
invested
greatness
in all of us, and, in all of us.
Yeah, and the country would have continued on that upward trajectory for all of the people rather than this internecine fight and hatred and everything that's going on. Not that I think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, but there is that level of authenticity. He says what he thinks, and he doesn't seem to worry about the polls. He doesn't seem to – Elizabeth Warren has fallen down and been greatly criticized. I love Elizabeth Warren, but still, she's been greatly criticized for backing off on Medicare for All and doing it really because of the polls and the criticism. And
which is unfortunate. See, I always would have said that my goal is to get to Medicare for All. I would have used the Canadian model to show people how you get there. I would and that way it's not like you're not getting there.
Mm.
What you're allowing is to figure out how the system will work so then you can make it work for the country.
And I do empathize with her greatly, because the fact of the matter is that there is a real world out there. There is practicality that one has to consider before you can implement Bernie's plans or anybody's plans. You have to get elected.
And Bernie voted for the Affordable Care Act, everyone. Mm-hmm. If Bernie was so virtuous, like you want to make him into, he would have said, no, it's not Medicare for All. I'm not going to touch it. He's never done that. He's never done that. He understands if we're moving in the right direction, then you get my support.
Right.
Ugh,
right.
I can't stand it.
But getting back to the journalism part of it, the guy is in there. He's a player. It's like saying, I'm the New York Times, and because I think Donald Trump is so reprehensible, I'm not going to cover him. Mm-hmm. You got to cover the world as it is. And you don't editorialize about it, but you at least let the world know that this guy's out there, Sanders, and that a lot of people are listening to him. A lot of people appreciate what he has to say. And MSNBC barely mentions his name.
That's because
MSNBC, the big liberal.
No, they're not liberal. No. They're an organ of the Democratic Party. Stop it. They're not liberal. The reason they're not covering Bernie is that Bernie's not a Democrat. He's not. No. He is not a Democrat. And I'm still – let me just say something. I am still pissed at him. When he decided in 2015 to run on the Democratic ticket, I hope that meant that he wouldn't drop out of the Democratic Party as soon as he lost. So this is what he does. He's like a smorgasbord. Oh, I'll try it this time. No, I'm not like it. Let's try it this time. Look, I've stuck
you
in
You could
this.
Say I tried it this time and I lost, so I don't like it.
Yeah, but he came back. Mm-hmm. And he came back to what? He's not running as a Green, as an independent. And I am sorry for people like me who've had their teeth kicked in, who stayed in this damn party forever because I want my party to be better. I was so grateful that he jumped in. I was so grateful that he helped to show about the rot in the DNC. I am so grateful that he was able to show the rot of the superdelegates. But he ultimately undermined some of that message when he then just immediately left. It's like, well, no wonder the Democrats are ticked off at you, but I'm ticked off at you because I feel hurt because I needed his help.
Well,
and frankly,
you thought that he was authentic on that as well.
I didn't think he was authentic. I think he made a decision. I will run here. And part of the reason I'm going to run here is not just to run on this ticket to take the advantages of being on the Democratic side of the aisle, but to also make the investment of making it a better party.
Right.
I am disgusted that he left. I will just be honest with you.
So, again, I'm not going to defend Bernie, but journalism, it really bothers me.
As much as this bothers you about Bernie,
it really bothers me that journalism, the New York Times, the Washington Post,
they're pathetic. Owned
by Jeff Bezos, are owned by corporate capitalists, MSNBC is owned by Democratic Party, whatever it is, Arnie, if you're going to put yourself out there as journalists and reputable journalists, and the American public believes you're reputable – you bloody well ought to actually cover all the news and not just leave out the people you don't want to cover.
We need to get to our first guest, but let me just say something. I still think that if people ask who is the most trusted politician in America, I think it's still Bernie. It was a couple of months ago. I think it's still Bernie. Probably he is the most trusted, and the most trusted politician who's not a politician is Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so there she's like, all right, that, but she's not a politician. She was married to one, but she's not. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone keeps wanting her to be one. Not yet, exactly. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure she ever wants to be one, to be honest with you. But I still think he is the most trusted. And maybe that's another reason to be angry, is that you want to elevate what's trusted. You don't want to elevate rot. And that's what we do all the time when we cover Donald Trump. All right. On that note, everyone, oh, my God.
I'm going to look for McKinsey's list of projects that Pete Buttigieg worked on.
I Blue Cross Blue Shield, the company in Canada. I already know. I did all that. So before we grab my next guest, my first guest was Ken, sort of. I always have an aside when I post on my Facebook page. And since today is really dedicated to climate, to the health of our planet, to how we need to care for each other, and that we're in this boat together, everyone. Nobody can really jump off the boat. The boat is planet Earth, and we need to figure out how to work together to make things happen. And our first conversation is going to be with a lawyer and someone who wrote a piece, I think it was at the Yale Climate Connection, I think that's where I saw it, about storage issues when it comes to energy. And you know that when it comes to batteries, I'm like the queen. But this is a really interesting conversation about storage, and it goes far beyond just the conversation of batteries. And in fact, it begins with, you know, before, other than batteries, what have we been using? And I found that really fascinating. But I want to share with you my aside for today. And this is very important because I actually think this is totally unnecessary, and I'm glad the scientists are recommending that we do it. This is from an article at the Daily Mail in the UK. Scientists call for a complete ban on glitter. Can I repeat the headline? Scientists call for a complete ban on glitter. Now, this is why. Because the particles are polluting oceans and hurting marine life. And here are the four nuggets of information about glitter, everyone. Glitter is made of a microplastic known as mylar, which is hurting ocean life. This plastic accounts for 92.4% of the 5.25 trillion pieces of plastic in the ocean. Marine life is mistaking glitter for food, which is damaging their livers. Every tiny, sparkly bit takes thousands of years to break down. So can I ask you a question? Can you live without glitter? I think you can. Do we need glitter for any really rational reason? I think not. Can we easily ban glitter? You bet your bottom britches we can. So I just want everyone to know that this was just such an interesting article at the Daily Mail in UK, and I think this is a conversation we need to have. It is so important. There are things that we can do easily, and we won't even really significantly understand or comprehend what we are losing because we don't need it. We will live a perfectly wonderful life without it. But I want to remind everyone, let me read you the headline again. Scientists call for a complete ban on glitter because the particles are polluting oceans and hurting marine life. So there you go. Someone said that one of those porn stars, they like glitter. They said they may feel depressed about losing glitter, but what are you going to do? Anyway, I'll figure out.
Plenty to be depressed about.
That's true, too. They're in the wrong line of work. Yeah. All right. So today is dedicated to climate. And I did see a piece at the Yale Climate Connections, and it was entitled An Introduction to the State of Energy Storage in the U.S., Finding Effective Ways to Store Solar and Wind Energy When the Sun Isn't Shining and the Winds Aren't Blowing is Critical to Increasing the Use of Renewable Energy Sources. So joining us right now is the author of that fabulous piece, which, by the way, really was fabulous, Philip. Philip Warburg is an environmental lawyer and a former president of the Conservation Law Foundation. And I want to welcome Phil to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, this was, honest to God, it was a long article, but it really is our roadmap, Phil, because I was taking notes and I'm thinking, oh, God, just go through the whole damn thing. But start with what we have been using historically for storage. Obviously, it's not a battery. It's how you begin. And you talk about all these different ways that we've been doing it. One of the problems I realize is when you need a lot of land use, perhaps, to create the storage opportunities, it's not cheap. It's not exactly very versatile. But I didn't even know about some of these techniques that are being used. And yet, while those techniques are important to know about, it almost makes batteries more attractive by the minute. So why don't you begin with the alternatives to storage, because that's really going to be important if we're going to look at alternative energy, if we're going to have a sustainable environment, and we're looking at things that's not oil and coal and gas. We need storage more than we need almost anything else if we're going to make it viable and also address the increasing needs for electricity going into the future.
Well, I'll give you a bit of background on the non-battery storage technologies, though I think that batteries really are
the
storage
yes.
future.
Yes.
The most commonly used storage vehicle today is actually pumped hydro storage, which means that
you pump
water into an upper basin when you have a surplus of electricity, and you release it when you want more electricity on the grid. It's a very effective way of storing. It does occupy a fair amount of land.
Exactly.
And it's not necessarily cheap, but it has been used for decades. We're not seeing new plants built because of the economics and because batteries are coming in. One newer technology, in some sense, is the use of molten salt. There are certain kinds of solar plants called concentrating solar power facilities that generate heat rather than using photovoltaics, and they store that heat in molten salt, which can be then released whenever the market says, let's get more power on the grid.
Okay.
And That is being used. That is also quite a costly option and is only being used at a few large facilities in the Southwest. And we've also seen some flywheels.
What's a flywheel?
A flywheel is basically a heavy metal wheel that, through its kinetic energy, stores electricity and, again, can release it very quickly. It's very advantageous for what's called frequency regulation, which means keeping the voltage on the grid at an even 60 volts, 60 hertz, and that can be accommodated well through flywheels, but flywheels have not exactly had a stellar economic past. One of the key companies went bankrupt, then came out of bankruptcy. We're not seeing more of those facilities built. So what we're really looking at now is the use of batteries, and specifically the dominant battery resource is lithium ion, which is accounts for about 80% of utility scale battery storage today.
Okay, so let's start with the good news about lithium batteries, and then let's talk about the bad news about lithium batteries, because like everything else, it's not a 100% Nirvana story. But let's talk, because lithium batteries really are quite remarkable when it comes to the issue of storage, and I want people to understand why they've been embraced and why they really look like a potential solution, except that its downside, I think, is not equally problematic, but clearly problematic.
Yeah. So we're all familiar, whether we know the term or not, we're very familiar with lithium-ion batteries. Most people are having them in their pockets or holding them in their hands,
exactly,
using their smartphones or their iPads. Electric vehicles also operate on lithium-ion batteries. The batteries have the advantage of being compact, scalable, responsive. They do have a number of downsides.
Yes.
And they're also, frankly, I don't want to say cheap, but the price of them has come down about 85% in the past 8 years.
Wow.
And they really are now competitive with other forms of, you could say, power generation when coupled with solar power. And we're seeing that happen in states where power rates are relatively high. So, for example, in Hawaii, on the island of Kauai, the planned storage facilities paired with solar should be generating about 65% of that island's nighttime peak power needs in the coming years.
Well, it makes so much sense for Hawaii, as your article points out. I mean, Hawaii is an island. It has to ship in any kind of diesel or oil that it needs. So given the fact that it's got lots of sun, given the fact that, its remoteness, it really does look at alternative energy as its really significant energy source, because it would also create economic stability for them. It would ensure that they have the energy they need when they need it. And they also tend to be a state that is really very sort of climate aware and climate sensitive, so they're enlightened. So the combination is a win-win-win for them.
I think that's right. But Hawaii is by no means alone in building utility-scale storage. And a number of states, 29 states plus the District of Columbia, have what are called renewable electricity standards, which set minimum amounts of electricity from what are called qualifying renewable energy sources that must be implemented by utilities by certain dates.
Yeah.
So in California, by 2030, 60% of its electricity is to come from those qualifying renewable energy sources. Hawaii sets its standard at 100% renewable energy by 2045. And closer to us in New England, Vermont has set a standard of 75% renewables by 2032. And your state, New Hampshire, 25% by 2025. So we are looking at the ramping up of renewables, and the challenge there is, as people know, renewable energy, specifically solar and wind, are great resources. They're super abundant. I can talk more about that if you'd like. But the the factor that we have to take into account is that they are intermittent sources of energy, and that's where storage really comes in.
Let's get to the lithium problem though, because there are so many problems with lithium, and the flammability issue is just one example of it. Obviously, the mining of lithium is another example of it. So let's talk a little bit about the negatives of lithium, mm-hmm. and whether we can actually address some of those negatives rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Are there issues that we can do? Here's the checklist. This is what's wrong with lithium batteries. Now, are there ways for us to address some of those flaws or failures in order to continue to use lithium batteries, number one? And number two, do you have to completely change the battery in order to address those liabilities?
Right. So the downsides include that they're not very efficient at higher temperatures, which means that you have to use a fair amount of power to keep those batteries cool. Oh. And if you're using those batteries in hot climates like Arizona or California or Hawaii, that cooling cost can be pretty substantial.
Right.
They also have a limited cycle life, which means the number of times they can be recharged. So that's a constraint. It's a constraint with any battery. It just depends upon how many of those cycles you can
Well, that would
absorb.
Be true with cars especially, I suspect.
Yes. And as you mentioned, there is a risk of fire. We've all heard the stories of the exploding Teslas and the Samsung smartphones catching fire. And earlier this year in Arizona, the Arizona Public Service, which is the largest utility in the state, has a couple of these large solar plus storage facilities that use lithium-ion batteries. And there have been a couple fires there that have been pretty disturbing. So people are looking actively at other technologies that could incorporate lithium-ion in different configurations or could use other metals. Mm-hmm. They're also looking at solid-state batteries that would use ceramics or solid polymers.
Mm-hmm.
They're also looking at something called flow batteries, which basically is a liquid or a gel that can be stored outside the battery itself and can be easily scaled up by virtue of having a larger storage capacity. I think what we have to recognize is that batteries are this kind of application for batteries is very new. It's ramping up very quickly. We are seeing new technologies on the near horizon. That doesn't necessarily mean they're commercializable today, but within the next 5 to 10 years, I think we're going to see some alternatives to these lithium-ion batteries.
You know, I remember when JFK saw Sputnik, and he got really upset, and he said, you know, we need to win this race. And his great line is, someday we're going to put a man on the moon, and then he funded it. So here's my question. How are we doing with the funding issue? It sounds like batteries are essential for our both climate future, for our energy future, for frankly our security future. I mean, you can check off almost every box, and the battery is part of the solution, if not 100% of the solution. And given the fact that we see some problems with lithium batteries, given the fact that we're going to see a huge need in additional electricity because of our decision to get off of the fossil fuel teat and move into this electric teat, the problem is if it isn't, you know, funded by alternative or creative by alternative energy and storage, then it really is an alternative. You know, if you're using diesel for your electricity, that's not good. But if you're using the sun, that's wonderful. But the reliability is the issue, which is why storage is the issue. So I guess the question is it only in the private sector that we're seeing significant investment in creativity and looking for alternatives and trying to figure out how to make it both the most safest and versatile aspect of how we store energy? Or is the government putting anything into it in order to help us get there sooner?
Well, there is a lot of commercial development going on, commercial R&D, because it's seen as a huge growth market.
Right.
The feds are putting some money into R&D. I think they should step that up. I think it should be a national priority.
Mm-hmm.
The markets on the state level need to be opened up to storage, and that's happening in a number of states where tax credits and rebates are making it more desirable to incorporate storage into, let's say, a solar facility or a wind power plant.
Right.
And as those incentives develop, people in the private sector, utilities and independent power producers, are going to be more interested in investing in storage, and that in turn is going to drive technology development because people want safe and sustainable sources of power. And you did mention before, I think, that one of the problems with lithium and some other battery sources is that rare earths and other metals are mined in countries that often do not have good laws vis-a-vis child labor. They also do not necessarily have good environmental regulations. Mm-hmm. So we've got to really look at the full life cycle of these batteries to see what their impact is, not just upon the overall climate crisis, but on the local environment.
Well, you know this, Phil. As old environmentalists, we're both old, is that the idea of cradle to grave.
Yes.
And we have to and we don't talk about this enough, Phil. You know, we look at the little window where we benefit, or we look at the opportunity, but we don't look at the beginning to the end, whether it's, you know, how we mine it or how we get rid of it. You know, it's in the end, it has a birth and it has a death. And we need to know everything from the birth to the death to understand why we need to value this form of battery over that form of battery. But I am a storage fanatic. And one of the reasons is that I believe in the democratization of energy. I believe that in some ways we should all be our own power sources. I believe that because I think it offers a level of security. We're not going to be dependent on the grid. I think it keeps us more connected to what's really happening with our own particular energy use. I think it will help the climate. Before I let you go, could you talk about why, you know, the other reason why storage is so important is for something called microgrids. And given the fires in California, and given what we see with the hurricanes, and given what we see with the floods, and given what we see with everything, we are so vulnerable if we are on one massive grid. But if we can create microgrids, it really does protect all of us from going down because the grid isn't impacted by it.
I think that's exactly right. I think Puerto Rico is a great example. In Hurricane Maria 2 years ago, the entire island lost power for months, and there was enormous human hardship that resulted. The Puerto Rican utility today is planning 8 microgrids that would basically be a lot more resilient in the event of another storm, so that if there were a grid failure, those microgrids could be disconnected from the central grid and could operate with solar and with storage. So they're both renewable energy reliant.
And I need to let you go. I just want to remind everyone that when you invest in Wall Street, they tell you that you should diversify your portfolio. The reason why I like microgrids, it's kind of like diversifying your portfolio. Phil Warburg, cradle to grave, diversifying your portfolio, and storage. Those are the 3 words we learned today. Thank you so much for joining us. It was really great. And we'll talk to you again. I have this funny feeling.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, everyone.
Labor history.
Labor. Oh, yeah, labor. That's what I'm going to play. This is The Attitude with Arnie Onassis and producer Ken Barnes. So labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day streetcar workers in Kansas City walked off the job. It was the 3rd strike since August 1917. Workers had previously struck for union recognition and joined the city general strike that spring. By summer, the city was so desperate for wartime labor, the transit company began hiring women. Though women faced initial opposition, by fall, the union demanded they receive equal pay for equal work. The company had been paying them $15 less a month than their male co-workers. The Amalgamated filed charges with the National War Labor Board, demanding a general wage increase and equal wages for women. The board quickly ruled in the union's favor, but Kansas City Railway refused to abide by the decision. And on this day, 2,675 men and 127 women walked off the job, demanding the company honor the board's ruling. Instead, the company hired scabs. In the rush to restore service, the company failed to properly train the scab drivers, and a number of streetcar crashes reduced the transit company's fleet by more than 300 cars. According to Maureen Wiener Greenwald, author of Women, War, and Work, the company alleged in the press that the strike was an attack against the entire community. On the Missouri side, state militia guarded the strikebreakers, while U.S. Marshals guarded rail tracks on the Kansas side. By April 1919, a federal grand jury indicted union leaders for obstructing a vital industry during wartime, even though the war had been over for 6 months. By May, the strike was lost and the union busted. It would take another 20 years before Kansas City Transit would finally be organized. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
A Nicaraguan teenager fled her home after participating in student-led protests, where she was tear-gassed while peacefully marching in the streets and where one of her friends was shot in the head and killed next to her. And then the story gets worse. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. I am sharing with you an email I received from the ACLU, which goes on to say, as the government cracked down on protesters, her family was visited by men who said they were supporters of the government, and they told her sister that they would kill this teenager, along with the rest of her family. She thought the U.S. would provide a safe haven for her, and so she traveled to the border near El Paso, where she pleaded for asylum, and our government's response? She was placed into the Migrant Protection Protocols, the MPP, also called Remain in Mexico. That program unrolled this year forces asylum seekers who have reached the U.S. to remain in Mexico, where they have to fend for themselves for an indefinite period while awaiting their court dates in the U.S. This teenager is now stuck in Ciudad Juarez, a city known for cartel-related violence and mysterious disappearances of young women. Sadly, this story is not unique. Persons placed into MPP face insecurity, homelessness, and extreme danger. The ACLU says MPP is illegal and has gone to court to challenge the Trump administration. Hopefully in court, decency and due process will prevail. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island, yeah. From the Redwood Forest, well, to the Gold Street Water. Ooh, let me tell you that this land was made for you.
Oh, what a great version of that song. Oh, my God. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. This Land is Your Land is sung by
Sharon Jones.
I'm going to get more of
her. She's
stuff.
A rocker.
She is incredible. That is just amazing. And, of course, it makes so much sense that we should be playing that song for our next guest. So before I introduce Matt Russell, who's the executive director of the Iowa Interfaith Power and Light, let me start with a shout-out to Stefan Schmidt. For 20 years now, I have been doing radio with Stefan, first on Iowa Public Radio back many, many decades ago. And now he's a regular on my radio show. And he is from Iowa State in Ames, Iowa. And it is not uncommon for Stefan to send me stuff and for me to send him stuff because we want to make sure that we both are learning about what's happening in our world, that we cover politics, and that we connect our politics to the lives we lead and the choices that we make. And he is the one that sent me an article about Matt Russell, the head of the Iowa Interfaith Power and Light. And what he didn't know was that I had seen another article about Matt Russell, only I hadn't gotten to the last paragraph, which is where Matt was discussed, and it was from Politico. And it was so funny that Stefan and Arnie were on the same page and sending each other articles, but not exactly the same article, but talking about the same individual. And it was entitled, How a Closed Door Meeting Shows Farmers Are Waking Up on Climate Change. And here's the subtitle, Purdue Vilsack and leading agricultural groups gathered in a Maryland barn to talk about the farm country issue that dares not speak its name. So let me welcome Matt Russell to the program. And Matt, it's just so funny. It's like we can't call it climate change, but we know there's a problem. We know we have to address it, but we can't call it by its name. And it's like, oy vey, you know? So Matt, let's start first by describing who you are and who this and what this organization is, the mission of the organization that you are the executive director of, because I love your bio, I love this organization, and I think what you are doing is not only making change in Iowa, but you have done a brilliant job at connecting what farmers know and the climate crisis to what's now coming out of the mouth of the 2020 candidates for president. So mazel tov on that point. Mm-hmm. But first, tell my audience a little bit about Matt.
Well, thank you, Arnie. It's absolutely a delight to be on with you, and thanks for the invitation. So I'm a fifth-generation Iowa farmer. My husband and I farm. We bought a farm in 2005, 110 acres. We do retail agriculture. And I spent 12 years at the Drake University Agricultural Law Center before taking this job working on food and agriculture policy. I grew up on a 1,000-acre commodity farm, so I am completely steeped in agriculture from, you know, farmers market stuff that we do to corn and soybeans and beef cattle that I grew up on, and then working through just American agriculture in general, primarily focused on how do we do this more sustainably.
Well, you know, and yet you not only do you have that agriculture piece, but this is the faith piece. Tell me a little bit about you, Faith, and how you came to be the executive director of this organization.
So I became director of Iowa IPL in April of 2018, and it really was a transition. My early career coming out of high school, college, I was going to be a Catholic priest, got very close to study, mm-hmm. studying for the Diocese of Des Moines, taught religion at a Catholic high school in Las Vegas for a couple of years, worked for a couple of years organizing for Catholic rural life nationally on sustainable agriculture and food systems, and then spent about 17, 18 years doing secular work around food systems. And so in April of last year, really combined my biography, those two things, back together.
Wow.
Because I'm just absolutely convinced that if, as people of faith, we are called to do something about climate change,
yes.
one of the things that people of faith in Iowa can do that we can make the most difference is to create an on-ramp for farmers to lead on finding solutions. And so that was the work I put forward. The board hired me. We empower Iowans of faith and conscience to take bold and just action on climate change. And we are an affiliate of the national IPL, so there's 40 state affiliates doing similar work around the country. But we all do unique work for our own state. And so for us, it's carving out that leadership role for farmers.
What I love is threading faith and farm. I just think it's magical on a lot of levels. And my audience has heard me say this over and over again. I was on my way to divinity school. I'm now basically an agnostic, if not an atheist. But one of the things that I learned when I was studying religion was something that I learned from the Jewish faith. And they have this concept that, you know, everyone, you know, I come from a Roman Catholic family, and, you know, they're always talking about what happens on the other side, you know, going to God, going to heaven. And what the Jews say all the time is that you have an obligation to make your heaven here. And when you hear that statement, the idea of faith and farm is a natural connection. Because how do you not make your heaven here if you see that there is something happening to your environment that's not only impacting what you do for a living as a farm, but impacting how you live and what your future may look like? And therefore, if you're going to create heaven, you just can't sit on the sidelines and let it happen. I think you have an obligation to figure out how you can work with it and maybe even how you can fix it.
Going back to the first thing you said, I want to address that. You said that, you know, climate change, the words we can't dare say, and that is part of my faith journey, is understanding in the last 5 or 6 years of working on climate change in agriculture, is that when we take that position that farmers won't talk about climate change, or we can work on the problem without talking about the problem because of the politics, et cetera, what we're really saying is that we're going to leave farmers out of the solution.
Yes.
We're going to invite farmers to do practices around water quality, but we're not going to ask them to direct climate change directly. And what I realized is that we were going to be left behind as farmers because the world is moving. Trillions of dollars are being, you know, gathered to deal with this problem, both in public policy and taxes and the marketplace. And if we can't talk about the problem, we're getting left out. Mm-hmm. And what I realized in talking to actual Republican farmers running for public office in private conversations saying, no, Matt, I'm with you on this, but we can't say it publicly. I realized that I had a call to find on-ramps and find ways to change that conversation, not to trick farmers into doing practices that help with climate change, but to take it to a whole other level and get farmers leading.
Let me read one sentence from Politico, and this is referencing exactly what you just said, but here's what it says. It says, in Iowa, faith leaders have been engaging farmers on the topic, hosting discussions in churches and buildings, building a network of farmers who are comfortable speaking publicly about climate change, whether it's telling their story to reporters or 2020 Democratic candidates. So in a lot of ways, you're giving them an on-ramp. You're also making them comfortable with the words. You're making them comfortable with understanding that to not say it is not going to make it disappear. To say it is to acknowledge it, which is not a bad thing, and that what farmers do is so damn practical anyway. How do you not acknowledge something? Because in a way, it's denying who you are.
Right. And that is the work that we are doing. And it's been frustrating in the past trying to pull together the funding for this and to – you know, a year ago when we were trying to launch this, we literally were told, no, this isn't going to work. Farmers aren't going to talk about it. And so we didn't have any funding. We went ahead and just asked Iowans and said, this is the work that needs to be done. We're going to jump in and do it. What we're doing is identity work with farmers. We're not asking them to change their identity
around
climate. We're asking them to embrace their identity as problem solvers. And that's something that we wake up in the morning. Every farmer in this country wakes up and that's the number one thing they do. What problems do I have to solve today? And so it's an identity that connects us across political landscapes, across scale of agriculture, across production systems, marketing systems. And we've really been able to get farmers talking to each other and develop a common message that's rooted in the identity of who we are as farmers. And that has changed the world.
But, Matt, what I think is so interesting, too, is that not only are farmers – this is their identity, but farmers understand science. Farmers understand math. Farmers, you know, are observant of the weather. They're also observant of changing weather. They know patterns. That's how they live, you know? So in so many ways, addressing climate is not only something that they can do or should do, it almost describes who they are.
Well, yes, we are so connected to the weather,
exactly.
So connected to
climate.
And we've been asked to embrace climate change as the victims, and we've been asked to embrace climate change as the cause and the villains.
Yes.
Both of those things are true, but they're true for everybody.
Yes.
What's unique for farmers is that we can actually wake up in the morning and do our job as farmers and make the transition on our farms, innovate, which is what we do all the time. For 10,000 years, farmers have been innovating around agriculture. We wake up in the morning, and if we're invited to, we can change our farms to solve this problem.
You have in the article. There's these five things that they can do. I just want people to hear these five practices. None of which are denial, blame. None of them will fix everything. But listen to this. So you write, there are five practice areas for farmer innovation that will be used to maintain their productivity of commodities, which is what they have to do. At the same time, develop environmental services that the world desperately needs. Wow, a win-win is what it sounds like to me.
Right.
And here are the five, everyone. And then I want you to go into them because I want people to hear them. Conservation tillage. No-till is an example. I didn't understand no-till and conservation tillage until I read these articles. I was like, oh, my God, we have to have you come on every week and teach us. And then here's another one, integrating livestock. No, in a lot of ways, we are ignorant. You know, what we know about farming? We go to the grocery store. That's what we know about farming. I just want people to understand the level of ignorance is overwhelming. So at the same time, so if we're going to embrace what you know, what you do, and what you can do to fix it, we have to understand what it is that you can choose to do and why we need to value it other than getting a corn on the cob. Okay? I mean, I think this is really important. So you have conservation tillage. You have integrating livestock. Rotational grazing is an example. You have permaculture. Cover crops and woody vegetation are two examples of keeping roots in the ground all year. Extending crop rotations, expanding crops on a whole farm basis, drawing on 10,000 years of genetics rather than relying on only a narrowing set of crops. And then this is one of my favorites that people will not be surprised by, generating energy. On the farm, solar, wind, and methane digesters are examples. I mean, all of these are so interesting. And yet we know so little about them, and yet why they are part of the solution.
Well, th- those we talk about practice areas because we don't want just a checklist. Because that's what the top of the supply chains are telling us, is that, look, farmers, if you do these things and these things, and you verify that you've done them, then we can claim that our supply chain is sustainable, and we'll be able to, you know, green halo sell products. But what we really need and what the world needs isn't farmers to just implement somebody else's strategies. We need to challenge those farmers and reward them with payments to innovate around those practices so that my farm, which looks different than my neighbor's farm, which looks different than a farm in New Hampshire or New Mexico, mm-hmm. we are actually asking farmers to be those entrepreneurial, problem-solving, creative souls to put together on their farming operation not only the goods that they grow, but what are the environmental services that have public value, and that we value that and we reward them for delivering that. It's a whole new revenue stream for farmers, and if we don't have farmers innovating, then we actually stagnate the innovation. If we leave it to the top of the supply chain, they're going to only innovate around their market power and their products.
Right.
We need farmers to innovate around public good.
Wow.
And reward them for doing it.
So
we already know it. Like we are, that's an ethic of ours. We feed people. We are rooted in our communities. We have these ethics that are part of our identity. We need to unleash that to solve climate change.
So there was another article that I read, how Iowans drove the national debate on carbon farming. And this is going to be my wet kiss to Beto O'Rourke. My show airs on KPFT in Houston, Texas. So we've been following Beto for a long time. When he ran against Ted Cruz, and then, of course, when he jumped into the 2020 campaign, one of my neighbor's sons who used to work on Beto's campaign, so I knew a lot about Beto. But I did not know this about Beto. So what we know is that Beto entered the race with a lot of promise, and then just a couple of weeks ago, he ended up dropping out of the race. And people keep saying, well, we had too many people in there. You know, we didn't need him. Maybe he didn't make a contribution. This article was so powerful because it showed me whether he dropped out or not, we needed Beto O'Rourke in this race for 2020. Because it was Beto O'Rourke that read an article in the New York Times. And it was an article about exactly what you've been talking about, Matt, and about Iowa and about farmers and about the climate crisis, about the contribution, about what can happen and how they can be part of the solution. They need to be engaged in this. This is what they do naturally anyway. And he read the article Beto did and reached out to you. And I want to talk a little bit about that because this is a way where every once in a while you think, you know, does anyone read what I write or do I make a difference? Whatever you wrote in the New York Times not only made a difference for Beto O'Rourke and his, flailing campaign for president, but he changed the conversation for all the other 2020 candidates running for president. Can you share with my audience that story of Beto? Because it's a story of the fact that you need to keep doing it because you never know who's going to open that door and say, wow, this is a really good idea. Tell me more.
Well, it's first a story about those people in New Hampshire and Iowa who take so seriously the retail politics of the responsibility we have to vet these candidates and help them learn.
We do.
And what Beto did was he came in, he read that piece, he called me, he called some other folks, he sat down with farmers, and one day he sat down with us and we had a long conversation, and the next day he had a public statement that he changed his policy, changed the way he was talking about farmers and climate based on sitting down and listening to folks in Iowa. That's a powerful thing. This has been moving not because we came up with a tricky idea or consultants focused group a great
right.
idea. This is farmer driven. This is the people of Iowa talking to each other, coming up with a message, and these candidates coming in and listening. And that's something that we need to really celebrate. And Beto was the first one to do that in a big way, and he had a perfect record.
And good ideas clone. Matt, good ideas clone. Let me read from the article. Now, nearly all the Democratic hopefuls are privy to the concept of paying farmers for their conservation efforts, and most have included the idea in their agricultural, rural, or climate policies. I just want people to know what Beto did by reaching out to you, what you did by sitting down and talking to him and explaining it to him. Not only did he get it, but you inspired him to make it part of his policies. And of course, you know what it is. Nobody's original. We all copy each other, but these are good copies. You know, this is the kind of cheating I love because it's not cheating. It's actually learning about something that if you hadn't been exposed to, you wouldn't understand how critical farmers are to having this conversation about climate change and addressing the climate crisis. It isn't that, you know, they do have some things to be blamed for, but they own certain problems that they have exacerbated, not intentionally, unintentionally. Well, there are ways of addressing those unintentional problems, but then it turns out that there are ways that they could go far beyond that and actually help us solve the problem.
And our goal was not to pick specific policy objectives. Our goal was to change the conversation. So instead of in really engaging with the idea that farmers can lead, and that when they lead, they need to be paid for their innovation because that's how economics work. And smart public policy, just like we do across agriculture, needs to move in a direction to resource these farmers with taxpayer dollars, this partnership between farmers and taxpayers. So that's the 30,000-foot frame, you know, the 30,000-foot message. And then every single candidate has developed their own policies around that message.
It's amazing. Well, let me give you an example. So in the article, it says incentivizing farmers to capture carbon. These are two sentences. The world will not get to its necessary net zero emission status on time unless food production and land management is drastically reformed. Now, farmers start getting nervous. They hear that. They read that. Go, oh,
but.
Agriculture is unique in that it is the one sector with an ability to transform from, are you ready, everyone, a net emitter of carbon to a net carbon catcher. All right? This is incredible. There is no other human-managed realm with this potential. May I repeat that sentence? There is no other human-managed realm with this potential. You are a savior. That's what's so amazing about this. Describe what carbon capture is. What is it? What does it mean? And how can farmers do that?
Basically, we've got too much carbon in the atmosphere. How do you get it out of the atmosphere and put it someplace else? Well, plants actually do that. They grab the carbon, dioxide, and then they use it to build and grow. And some of it goes into their roots. And if we actually manage that, think about it this way. If we all stepped back and just ate from nature, right, and we had no agriculture, we just ate from nature, we couldn't sustain this many people on the planet.
Right.
But because we're using the practice of agriculture and human ingenuity and partnering with creation, we've accelerated those cycles so that we can produce a lot of food. We can do the same thing with this carbon cycle. If we apply human ingenuity and we accelerate that process, then we can really start to not just step back and let plants take over, but manage our whole farms so that we are, you know, it's a complicated process, so I won't go into all those details. But essentially, we're taking the carbon from the atmosphere, we're pulling it down, put it into our soils. We do two things. We store that carbon and get it out of where it doesn't need to be, and we put it to work on our farms. Our soils get better and more productive. So climate action, climate solutions, actually makes our farms more productive. But it also changes the system of agriculture. We can't have just a narrow set of commodities being grown globally and narrowing. We need to expand that. So climate action does threaten agriculture in terms of the system. But it's not a threat to farmers. It's an opportunity for farmers. It's a threat to global supply chains that are very dependent on an agriculture that is very environmentally leaky. But if we close up those leaks and we actually produce environmental benefits along with what we're growing, it's an upside. It's a positive disruption.
So how do we get the supply chain boys into this conversation? Because this is my problem. You talked about the environmentally leaky. Well, these are the guys that make lots of money. These are the guys that have big lobbyists. These are the guys that sort of, you know, basically make sure that the regulations don't exist or the regulations benefit them. So what's successful for farmers is not necessarily what is going to make supply chain folks successful, because they see profit as their success and they just want to get to profit. So how do we get them into the conversation, because they have to live on this planet too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we start with public policy, because that's where farmers have the most power, right?
Okay.
And we have a lot of political power. We haven't been using that, and we haven't been invited into the discussion around that power that we have as innovators. And so we need to step up, and that's what we're seeing farmers do. And what we're seeing from at least the Democratic candidates is listening. But we're also engaging Republican leaders, because this is not a Democrat versus Republican debate.
No.
If you've got Republican ideas, we need those unleashed to address climate. We don't need you to become a Democrat. We need you to bring your Republican ideas to this problem. And so it's really engaging on the political around public policy. And if we can shift some of those resources, then we can start to position farmers in a better place as far when carbon markets are emerging. If we just step back and we just wait, we will be in the same place we are now, which is we're reacting to the top of the supply chain, told what to do. Public policy complements that, and you know, we continue to produce commodities at cheaper and cheaper prices, including environmental services. But this is our opportunity. This is like horses and harnesses to tractors and hybrids. This is right. 1936. Right. We can either stay with horses and harnesses and think that agriculture is going to stay the same, or we can understand that it changes. And in the next 20 years, we are going to have as big a transformation in agriculture as we had from 36 to 56, you know, from horses and harnesses to tractors and hybrids. We're at that moment, and it's our opportunity as farmers to lead that.
Right. And I want farmers to understand that when we acknowledge that there are some problems related to farming, nobody is blaming them. This is the part that you mentioned the digesters, and as soon as I hear about the digester, I keep thinking about the cow farts, you know? No one's
right.
blaming anyone because cows fart or that you raise cattle, you know? Please stop.
Right.
And because then you have to blame me for what I do with my house and too much energy consumption and the car that only gets 15 miles to the gallon.
Or for eating the food.
Or for eating, exactly. So this isn't a blame game. And I think we all have to sort of understand that we all have contributed to the problem, but we also have the power to fix the problem. And I think
right.
that's what's so hopeful about what you do, Matt Russell. Let me read the last line in this one article. There's a solution that came out of the Iowa caucuses to help fight global warming, to help stabilize our soil, to help make our water purer, to help dead zones in the ocean that once we implement it could help solve the international climate crisis. Thank you so much for caring so much. Thank you, Beto, for making that phone call. And thank you for giving people on-ramps. They need to feel safe. They need to have the conversation because in the end, they want to resolve it too. So thank you, Matt Russell, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right, everyone.
And let's hope that many more candidates are open-minded enough, like Beto, to listen to what other points of view are and maybe even change their own minds on what needs to be done.
But Beto, by putting it as part of his solutions, his policies, the other Democratic candidates noticed right away. And all mm-hmm. of them started asking questions. All of them started amending their climate positions, their agricultural positions. It only took one.
Yeah.
But it took Beto to call them. So Beto has contributed.
He's great.
But
I love him for that. All I'm saying is now that he's out of the race, somebody else needs to – all of them,
but they already are. And that was the point of this.
On other issues as well.
Right. And that's the point of this story is that others have.
Stuck in the party's narrative.
It has. We're going to make sure it sticks. All right.
So you want to end with think?
You got it. Here we go.